Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the Movie Geeks will bring you an exclusive live interview with legendary independent filmmaker John Sayles. Plus, we'll discuss some of this season's most highly anticipated theatrical and DVD releases. It's all coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Movie Geeks United is on the air. How's everyone out there doing tonight? A great Sunday night. My name is Jamie. I'm one of your co-hosts. My other two co-hosts are here with us too, Jerry and Chris. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Word.
It's great to have everybody here tonight. It's after the holiday. How was everyone's holiday? I know. It feels like Movie Geeks United tonight, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So how was the holidays, guys? Chris, how was yours?
Mine were fantastic. I wish it was a little colder down here. It's just too hot down here. I mean, it's not even hot, but it's not cold. It doesn't feel Christmassy
right,
to me,
right.
Even though most
it did,
of my
It did for one day this month, didn't it, in Florida?
Yeah, on Thursday it's supposed to be 35, which is like the high in many other parts of the country. So,
yeah, that
you know.
Is. But
whatever.
Let me ask you something. So we went, in 1984, we vacationed in Florida, and it was like the cold, we got like your record cold spell. Is that not so warm down there?
It happens occasionally, but it's getting rarer and rarer. I think the planet's melting. I don't know anything about that.
Al Gore will thank you for saying that.
You know, and it's just it doesn't feel like Christmas here in Florida. It just doesn't feel like the holidays. It's just you know, when your Christmas day is, you know, in the 80s, there's just something missing.
Yeah.
That's true. That's true.
My take on it. Yeah, you know, but I've never even seen snow. I'm ashamed to say. Isn't that something?
You've never seen snow?
No. You know that movie, The Bucket List? That's on my bucket list. See snow.
Folks, you heard it here first.
Yeah. Dream big. Okay, we got a great show tonight. A great show. And I want to remind everyone that you can subscribe to Movie Geeks United absolutely free through iTunes, and you'll automatically get our archive of great shows. Content like Brian De Palma and the cast of Redacted, Howard Shore, Mark Isham. Give me some other names, guys, that we've interviewed over the past few months.
John Badham. The cast of The Blair Witch and crew of The Blair Witch Project.
That's right. And Joey Pants, he came in to talk about his new movie, Canvas. Just a great archive of shows and great topics, great interview subjects, and movies that, for the most part, we feel very passionate about and so proud to bring your attention to, including tonight's film that we'll be talking about here at the top of the show. But please do that. It's absolutely free, and it's so convenient, and it'll automatically be downloaded into your system. We have a great series of shows set up for January, including a retrospective on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that's going to happen Sunday the 13th. We have several cast and crew from that film set up to reminisce about the experience of shooting that film, and that'll be amazing.
That'll be amazing because you're going from Dolph Lundgren that Friday to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is just incredible.
That's great. Isn't that what's great about our show? We have Dolph Lundgren and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and John Sayles. I mean, it's
amazing. It's amazing. You can't ask for better diversity, never.
That's it. So let's get started tonight. Anyone out there listening tonight, log on to our chat room. You can converse with our other listeners. And you can also call into our show at 718-508-9477 if you have any questions for our guests or for the Movie Geeks. So let's get started. We're very excited tonight to welcome director John Sayles to the show. He is a tremendous filmmaker whose stellar and versatile works include films like 8 Men Out, The Return of the Secaucus 7, Baby It's You, The Brother from Another Planet, City of Hope, Passion Fish, and Silver City. Each of his films are elevated by his profoundly independent spirit and his refusal to compromise his vision to satisfy typical Hollywood conventions. Now in his 16th gorgeously realized vision titled Honey Dripper, he tells the story of an aging juke joint owner in 1950s Alabama who has one last shot to save his beloved establishment and his fragile independence. Starring Danny Glover, Stacy Keach, and Charles Dutton, Honey Dripper is a fantastically entertaining and rich experience, possessing the keen understanding of character and place that mark all of Mr. Sales' astonishing work. It is a great honor to welcome to our program Mr. John Sales. Mr. Sales, are you with us?
I'm with you. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, you forgot to mention that I was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on stage.
That's right.
Yeah, I specialized for a long time in very large, very mentally challenged people. I played Chief Bromden and Lenny and Of Mice and Men and people like that.
And the Glass Menagerie, didn't you do a run?
Yeah, I was the son in the Glass Menagerie. Eventually, John Malkovich, who I just met about a month ago, was in the movie version of that theater production.
Sure.
With Joanne Woodward.
And talk about the great American play. I mean, the Glass Menagerie is it for me.
Yeah,
at least. Yeah.
And to get to do it with Joanne Woodward was just terrific.
So tell me about, since we've opened up the conversation here, I know that you act in some of your own films,
mm-hmm.
Some films of others. What does that give you? Why is that important to you to do that?
Well, you know, in my own films, it's sometimes a way not to have to pay for the airline ticket to bring another actor in, which saves us a lot of money. In Honey Dripper, quite honestly, once again being large. Danny Glover's about 6'3", I'm 6'4", and my character's on screen very short period of time, and he needs to be a little bit intimidating, so it helps to be, you know, there's not that many guys in American movies bigger than Danny, so that helps, and I've played a lot of cop number one in movies.
Sure, yeah, but your movies are known for, among other things, their tremendous performances.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think it's a way to keep yourself empathetic to the experience of the actor too.
Yeah, you know, I think it actually helps my writing even more than my directing. You know, the thing that a good actor does when he gets a part is first think about how does this person see the world?
Right.
You know, how when they walk into a room, you know, how do they interpret things?
Right.
And that's what you do when you write characters. A lot of the drama is not just that they want different things, but they actually see a different world when they walk into that room. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're not even, you know, barely speaking the same language. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons the characters in my movie, you know, they sound different. You know, they don't talk the same. They don't see the world the same. And, you know, that experience, and I'm usually a day player, so you also get the great experience of coming onto a movie set and people are auditioning for you without knowing it, because, you know, a day player, you know, the minute you say your last line, you're like furniture and nobody pays any more attention to you. You know, you just try to get out of the way really quickly. So nobody's really paying that much attention to you except, you know, let's hope this guy doesn't blow his lines and make us go into overtime. But you get to see technicians, I've worked with cinematographers, actors, you know, all kinds of crew people who I observed first by being in somebody else's movie.
Sure. Let's talk about your writing for a little bit, because, you know, among other things, you're known for doing script work for the big studios.
Mm-hmm.
You get handed a lot of high-profile projects from the studios, and whether it's a complete rewrite or just an original draft that you work
mm-hmm.
on for them. But is there a sense, because you don't know how much of your fingerprints will be on the final product, is there a sense of disengagement in that?
You know, I wouldn't call it disengagement. I would say you're just kind of like a carpenter. You know, you're not the architect, really. You're there to help them tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, a good carpenter, you might say, well, you know, if you put the windows over there, you're not going to get any light in the morning. But if they say, but that's where we want the windows, you do your best job to put the windows there.
Sure.
So you can't get, I certainly work harder when I work for a studio or for somebody else trying to help them. You know, I do more drafts. I have to think harder. I'm trying to make it something I would want to go see, but also that solves, you know, their problems, the first of which being they can get a green light when they hand it upstairs.
Mm.
You know, that's the first hurdle that they have to go back, you know, past. But, you know, you just can't get that emotionally involved, because at some point they may just say, oh, we just got such and such an actor. you know that 45-year-old woman, she's now 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I once sat in a meeting with John Frankenheimer, and I had about 3 or 4 days to write this script because there was about to be a screenwriter's strike, which I'm on strike right now as we speak. He said, oh, by the way, you know all the Chinese people in this story? Make them Japanese. I can get Toshiro Mifune. And I said, you know, well, the martial arts and the cultures are very different. He said, yeah, but I can get Toshiro Mifune. Now, if that was my picture and a studio said, we'll finance it if you make them all Japanese, I would have said, no, I'm sorry, they're Chinese. But, you know, luckily I knew something about Japanese culture and martial arts, and I thought, Toshiro Mifune is a great idea. You know, this is before Jet Li was around. You know, if it was today, I would have said, get Jet Li and we can keep him Chinese. But,
sure.
You know, so I did a very, very quick, you know, 4-day rewrite, and they ended up making the movie.
Do you ever come across a project, I think, what is it, Cold Case? That was one of the last
mm-hmm.
ones that you worked on. Do you ever come across a good quality project like that that you have an itch to maybe try out on your own? Does that ever happen?
You know, sometimes it does, but it's not like they're going to just give it to me and say, cast it how you want to and cut it how you want to. You know, generally when you're working for those companies, they're in such a high-stakes poker game that they're going to try to control every aspect of it so that they have a better chance of making a lot of money. So, you know, the casting is not necessarily who's the best actor for this or even who's the best known actor for this. It's kind of, well, who could kind of be acceptable as that character who's really hot right now?
Yeah,
and that can change from the time that you write it. You know, so at the last minute, they may just say, oh, no, we want this actor, who may not be really who you think would be good at it, but they're really hot at that moment. So that usually tempers my temptation. Plus, they're not offering it to me anyway. You know? So, it's not a good idea to get your hopes up against, you know, something that you know is not going to happen.
Sure. You talk about casting, and, you know, I see in Honey Dripper, I see Danny Glover and Charles Dutton together, and it just makes so much sense. Why hasn't this happened before?
Mm-hmm.
And in your own films, when you sit down to write them, do you write with particular actors in mind, or is that
You
kind
know,
of
I, I try not to because, you know, you don't want to start out the process being disappointed and mm-hmm. write something specifically for one person, and then they say no, and then they say, well, what happens to my character? I mean, I used to have this problem when I wrote, you know, before I started directing, the studio would say, well, who do you see as this character? And I'd always say Spencer Tracy, you know, and there just wasn't a Spencer Tracy around in those days, and you know, there still isn't.
Do they ask you who Spencer Tracy was?
Not yet. In those days, no. They
okay,
still
that's
know.
Good.
Today
okay.
they would, you know. You know, so what I do is I try to write it, and then I read it over a couple times. In the case of Honey Dripper, the first time I read it, I said, Danny Glover. You know, he solves 99 of my percent of my problems if I could get Danny Glover to do this. And luckily, he said yes right away. And so the next round of asking people to come and work for scale, we were able to say, well, here's the movie, here's a good part, it's only 5 weeks of shooting, and Danny Glover's the lead. And that gets you past the agent, at least, you know.
Yeah.
And then the actor can say yes or no on their own. But, you know, there's been movies where we couldn't even get past the agent.
On that first draft, like the first draft of Honey Dripper, do you write with budgetary concerns in mind, or do you leave that kind of consideration for your rewrites?
I try not to think about that stuff until the last draft. And the last draft that I do is usually after we've gone to the location, we've shown it to some local people who know more about, you know, how cotton gets picked or this or that or the other. So some of what goes into that last draft is local knowledge, as they say. But also, you know, I've gotten to talk with the first AD and the production manager and Maggie Renzi, who produces it, and they can come back to me and say, okay, here's an eighth of a page, and it's also an eighth of our budget. You know, is this that important, this shot? This is what this is costing. Or, and sometimes the answer is yes, it is worth it. Other times it's, well, does, you know, this have to be at night? Night shooting is more expensive than day. Or, you know, here's an actor who we have to pay for 6 days when he's not working because he says, yup. in another scene? Could you give that line to somebody else or have him just nod his head and then, you know, or eliminate him from that scene or whatever? So, you know, it's a very practical draft, that last draft. When I sit down to write a script, I do, though, have an idea of, okay, is this one that we could, you know, make fairly easily, or I could possibly finance myself, or is this just one of those dream projects that, like 8 Men Out, took 11 years from the point where I wrote the first draft until we got to make it?
Yeah, what a journey. With Honey Dripper, what were the first germs of the idea that struck you, and what did you wind up wanting to explore with that piece?
You know, I think the real seed of it came from, you know, my kind of long relationship with American music. I think, like most people, you grow up, you turn on the radio, and there's the music, and you like it or you don't like it, but you just kind of accept that there it is. And then as I got older, I started hearing little things that weren't, you know, top 40 rock and roll, or little traces of things. And so in my case, Sam Cooke led me to the blues and gospel, along with Ray Charles. And that automatically leads you into the past. And I was born in 1950, and I started realizing, oh, this music came from somewhere. You know, there's a lot of ingredients that went into this thing that we call rock and roll, and it wasn't always called rock and roll. And then as I got even older, I started to realize, oh, the electric guitar wasn't always around. What did that do? And so a lot of what Honey Dripper deals with is one of those kind of big watershed transformations. You know, it happened in Hollywood when the silent movies gave way to the talkies. Mm-hmm. And within 2 years, there were people who were just out of work, who couldn't make that transition. Or in some cases, there were directors who just said, well, that's not an art. I do silent movies, you know. And there were people who struggled with it. You know, Charlie Chaplin, you know, it took him quite a while to to make his first talkie movie. And really feel comfortable with it. So what happened in the music world when, you know, I think the players can sense these things quicker than the audience can. They saw that solid body electric guitar with the amplifier that came with it for the first time. An awful lot of them must have said, uh-oh, everything's going to change. And I either get on this thing that's leaving the station or I get left behind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful movie, and but music plays no small part in a lot of your films. And tell me how important music is in kind of fueling and inspiring your creative process.
You know, it comes in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes very literally, because I often write these epics that, you know, how am I ever going to get this thing financed when I'm not really working with a studio and it's so hard to raise money for everybody. There's a couple songs that I know are going to be in the movie, and I just put them on, and that just kind of gets you back into the fight. You know, Hazel Dickens singing some of the songs that showed up later in Mate Juan. You know, that took 7 years from the time that I wrote the first draft until we got to make it. And every once in a while, just look. You know, we had literally, we were leaving on the airplane the next day to go to West Virginia to set up our office. And the people who said they were financing it called and said, oh, they didn't approve our bank loan. We're not financing the movie, and we were just left flat. You know, so there were a couple of years there where we didn't do anything. And, you know, I just stick on Hazel singing a couple of these songs and say, this is worth doing. You know, that one song so encapsulated what I wanted the feeling of the movie to be that it, you know, kind of got our blood rushing again. Whenever I finish a script, I send it to Mason Daring, who's the composer I've worked with, on 15 of the 16 movies. Actually, the other Baby It's You, we didn't have any composed music, and I worked with Joel Dorn, who recently passed, who helped us with the music clearances. And, you know, we start talking about what's going to be the music voice of the movie. You know, I think I'm going to buy some songs, I send those back and forth. You don't always get the ones you want, so you have to have some alternates. We start talking about the menu of instruments, what the voice of the movie is going to be. In the case of Mate Juan, we listen to an awful lot of that kind of West Virginia, Kentucky, you know, hill music, and we decided, okay, everything in this music except for the banjo. You know, this just is not a banjo story, and also because the banjo, after Bonnie and Clyde, had gotten, you know, kind of used for car commercials and, you know, hillbilly comedies and stuff like that, and it just didn't fit the palette of that movie anymore.
Yeah.
So it's part of the, you know, the tone of the movie that you have to start with right away. In the case of Honey Dripper, we also had to, you know, almost all the music you hear in the film that's performed is performed live in the film. You know, I didn't want, just as, you know, in Limbo, I didn't want Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio to have to lip sync to herself, so
yeah.
She's singing live. I wanted, you know, Gary Clark Jr. and Eddie Shaw and all our great players, when they do a solo, they're really doing a solo. And every take of it is slightly different. You know, so we pre-recorded the drum so that we'd always be on the same beat. But other than that, we just did a very careful, you know, live recording of it so we could separate instruments later. And if you cut to the saxophone, we could raise the saxophone without raising any of the other instruments.
Yeah, and it does give it, it does have that electric feel like live music does. And music really does create a instant world,
mm-hmm.
feeling of the environment that you're in. And that's what your movies are probably best known for, the sense of community and location. And I know that you shot this in Alabama, but
mm-hmm.
but where does that come from? I know, I think I read where you hitchhiked across the U.S. when you were a teenager. Where does that awareness of,
you know, I think it really does come from being in different places and realizing part of what I'm getting here and part of what I'm feeling here and part of who these people are here is the place itself. And sometimes it's just a physical thing, you know, that is, you know, Matewan is in the hills and hollers of West Virginia. There's no escape. Everywhere you turn, there's a big mountain face, you know, right by you. Whereas in Lone Star, it's a widescreen movie, partly because there's this endless horizon. And it gives you just a different feeling. You know, in Limbo, you're in Alaska, and you walk out your door and you realize nature is big and I am small, you know, which
yeah.
doesn't happen in a lot of other places.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes it's just a physical thing, but also a culture, you know, and culture is a lot of who we are and a lot of, as I said before, how we see the world is about a time and a place. So, you know, Harmony, Alabama in 1950, where Honey Dripper is set, is different than the towns that we shot in to make the movie. You know, we shot in Greenville, in Anniston, where the Army base is. We shot in a town called Georgiana, which is the town that you see in the movie that has just railroad tracks in the center of the town. That's where Hank Williams grew up.
Mm-hmm.
That place existed in a time and place and was like nowhere else. And the things that people assume, you know, for instance, there's a little scene in the film where it's just a throwaway, but, you know, the people go to the back door of the hardware store and they pass the colored only entrance sign. Well, that was an assumption in most of those places. They usually didn't even have to have the sign because there weren't that many strangers who came into those little cotton towns. Everybody just knew. You're on this side of the street or that side of the street. You're on this side of the tracks or that side of the tracks. And if you're African American, you don't go to the front entrance.
Mm. What really impressed me about this movie too, particularly Danny Glover's performance, is you feel so much history in that character, and yet it isn't explicitly expressed. But I understand that you write character bios for each of your actors prior to shooting.
Yeah, you know, even if it's a small part, if it's a, you know, if it's a one-page part, you might get a half-a-page bio. Danny got something that was 7 or 8 pages long,
yeah.
And a lot of it, you know, and I included a CD, so he got the double set. a lot of it was his musical history. You know, he's playing a boogie-woogie piano player, and you figure he's 50-something in 1950. He grew up with the music. You know,
yeah.
His life is the first half of the 20th century in American music. So when he's a little boy, they're starting to play the blues. And the blues really didn't exist for very long before 1900. And then he was in New Orleans when Buddy Bolden and King Oliver were playing. And then, you know, he was around during the Ma Rainey, you know, kind of Bessie Smith thing when that stuff started getting on the radio and they started recording people, and he was with swing bands. And now he's playing basically jump music and boogie-woogie and old blues,
uh-huh.
And there's this new thing that shows up. And so a lot of what Danny needed to know is, what kind of piano player am I? Even to the point where, you know, Danny doesn't actually play in the movie, but the piano player we got to play the stuff, we made sure that he knew, oh, this guy has spent a lot of time in New Orleans because there's a style of piano playing that comes out of New Orleans that's different than anywhere else in the world. So that's a lot of what you want your actor to know, and it's not always in the script itself. So you want to give them that stuff that they can ammunition, because they're going to do their own work as well, but you want to get them started down the right track, and that's why I write those bios.
Yeah, I was wondering how much of it's a tremendous gift for an actor, I would think, but how much of a collaboration working up that backstory would be, because they have to have their own ideas.
You know what, I try to head them off, you know, because actors like nature abhor a vacuum, and what you find is if you don't give them something, they'll come with something of their own, and it may actually get them off the track, you know, all of a sudden.
Sure.
It's, well, I can't do that because my uncle beat me with a wire coat hanger when I was 3 years old, and he said, what, you know, but if you give them something, and that's the conversation you've had. One of the things is, this is a very ambitious movie, Honey Dripper. We only had 5 weeks to shoot it.
Uh-huh.
We can't really have those deep philosophical actor director who am I questions.
Sure.
On the set. I got to have those beforehand, and we do it in correspondence and over the phone, and then really on the set, it's about the blocking of the scene, and then really what you want to do is turn those good actors loose on each other. And so the collaboration, to a certain extent, has already happened by the time we get to the set. And then the next part of the collaboration is the actors with each other. We have so many good actors in this. You know, there's a great little scene between Lisa Gay Hamilton and Mary Steenburgen. And, you know, it's like a small play. And we had one day to shoot it. And they just, you know, Mary, we only had her for one day, and she just hooked into this other actor. And they're supposed to be people who have known each other for years and years and years and years and have this strange employer-employee, black-and-white, 1950 Alabama relationship. And they just knocked me out. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't do any directing, but a lot of my directing was, you're going in this direction, push it in this way a little bit more, or hold back a little bit more before you show that, or try to hide this from her, or whatever.
Yeah.
And then a lot of it is just the louder, softer, move a little to your right, move a little to your left stuff.
When you have great actors like that, I would think that a big discipline would be knowing when not to direct.
Exactly. I mean, truly the first couple takes, and we don't do that many takes, is just to see what they're going to do.
Yeah.
What are they going to bring? Because, you know, quite honestly, I try to just cast good actors to do something I have never seen them do before. You know, maybe I've seen a hint of it, but never on that scale or that size of a part. Or, you know, David Strathairn, who I've worked with, you know, 6 or 7 times. It's just, David, do something cool, you know. And each time it's a very different character, and it's always just fun to see who is he this time.
And
you know, what are they going to throw at us? Yeah.
Yeah. Why hasn't it gotten easier for you to fund these movies? You obviously attract a tremendous caliber of actor.
You know, well, that's the one thing that has gotten easier, and it's the biggest compliment we get is you know, the actors who say yes to basically working for scale and, you know, working hard and being in a movie that's not going to get, you know, $20 to $30 million of national advertising thrown behind it. What's gotten harder, I think, is just that unless your movies, no matter who you are, whether you're working in the studio system or outside of it, if your last couple movies didn't go platinum, the people who put money into movies are not, you know, they just don't see the upside.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're just not going to be on the hot list for that long, and we never quite made it. Also, and this is, once again, a very mixed thing, there's a lot more competition than there used to be.
Yeah.
When we started, our first movie came, we made it in 78, and it opened in 1980. You know, there were maybe 12 to 15 independent movies made, and the heads of the 3 or 4 companies that distributed those movies, the heads of the company would look at anything with sprocket holes. Now, there's 15 people under the heads of those maybe 20 companies that do that, and it's got to go up through a chain of people before that head of the company even says yes and watches 10 minutes of it on his DVD while he's making phone calls. And, you know, the Sundance Film Festival is getting 5,000 or 6,000 features
True.
Submitted every year. And some of those people, 3 years later, make a second film. And so, you know, the amount of competition there's still only 52 weeks in the year. There's still X number of theaters that show non-Hollywood movies. So, a non-Hollywood screen could show a different movie every week and have a pretty good movie, a watchable movie.
Yeah.
You know, and you just can't make money back to make your next film if it only plays for 1 week. So that's the difficulty that we're in. And you know, we're distributing Honey Dripper partly to find a way around that. And I think that, you know, the movie business, certainly the independent movie business, has got to start doing what the music business did, which is to find other avenues of attack, because the old system isn't working for people.
Yeah. So, but you did open this past weekend in New York and LA, was it? And,
yeah.
And what's the plan from here?
Well, we're going to try to hold those theaters in those big cities, and then pretty much start in Martin Luther King Day and the very end of January, we're going to start opening other cities. We'll never have that many prints at first, but we'll go to Atlanta, do an opening there. We're going to, we're going to be in the next 2 months in 17 different cities.
Wow.
Doing it the kind of legwork way, getting a little buzz going personally. We're doing a lot more stuff on the web than we used to, which is nice because it's direct and it doesn't cost as much as buying an ad. And because, quite honestly, you can, what they used to call narrowcast a lot more. So we've been doing a lot more interviews with music magazines, with modern guitar magazine, all that because of the music component of it. And just let's make every shot count instead of just spraying the whole neighborhood with a machine gun.
Yeah, yeah. That's well,
a good analogy.
Like all of your work, it's just a jewel of a movie. It's so joyous and soulful, and I urge everyone to try to locate it when it comes close to you, and definitely go see it. It's a great film.
Yeah.
Mr. Sales, thank you so much for
being
with
us.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thank you.
You're welcome back anytime you'd like.
Okay, bye now.
Thank you, Mr. Sales. Bye-bye now. That is John Sales, writer-director of Honey Dripper with Danny Glover, Charles Dutton. It will opening in New York and L.A. this weekend, and hopefully in the coming months it'll come closer to a lot of you guys out there in the other areas.
The boondocks.
The boonies. Yeah, but
that was
great.
A great interview. You really did a good job, and I think what was really good is he emphasized some, the difficulty it is.
Yeah.
It is a crowded playing field, and he really emphasized that very well.
It is true, and it's become so muddied now. It's kind of muddied the definition of what an independent film.
Yeah, but he doesn't give himself enough credit. He's made Silver City, Lone Star, City of Hope, Sunshine State, The Return of the Chicago 7. I mean, I personally, just for my own bias, I would say he has a leg up on like all the competition.
He's told
some of the great American stories of the last 50 years.
He is the quintessential American independent filmmaker.
Yes.
I mean, he's it. He's the top of the totem pole,
He's who we look up to, a lot of us.
Yeah. He's the shiznit.
there you go. I mean, I couldn't have picked a better word myself.
I know, but honestly, we all three we admire the heck out of John Sayles, and the way he makes movies and his tenacity to keep doing it.
To keep going every film, to keep going, starting out, he brings, he really sums it up perfectly in the interview that this is a challenge. Every time out is a challenge. It's a struggle, and he comes out on top.
But thank you so much for Mr. Sales for joining us tonight. It was a great honor to have him on. We hope everyone's enjoying it in the chat room and everyone that's listening live tonight.
I think I killed the chat room.
You killed the chat room.
I think no one's talking to me. People are just, I don't know, maybe they're, maybe there's some, also you got the football games on and everything. I don't know. I mean, I killed the chat room.
You got to actually, well, you spark some conversation.
I got Anthony Gerber in there. I don't know what Anthony's doing. He's probably telling people not to go see War, the Jet Li, Jason Statham movie that he's passionately against. So I don't
like anyone needs to tell anyone that.
I didn't know I saw it until like 2 days ago. I remember, oh my God, I paid money to see that shit.
Here's the topic. The top grossing films, the top 10 top grossing films of the year came out. Not quite that surprising. We all pretty much know what's on the list. Let me see if I can bring it up. I wanted to discuss this, and I don't have it near me.
Come on, bring it up. What site are you going to? I'll help you out. What site?
Oh, I'll look it up. I know that number 10 was Wild Hogs.
Well, that relates to a movie that you've seen just recently, though.
Yeah, and I'm gonna talk about it.
I know, but I just wanted to bring that up because I'm trying to wax your ego and whatnot, but.
I'm looking this up right now. Number one, I know, is Spider-Man 3. It's the number one film of 2007.
Can we hear Chris's reaction to that?
We can basically go down this list, and that'll be the reaction.
I want Spider-Man's react in every film.
Spider-Man 3 at $336 million. Shrek the Third, second place, $321 million.
Okay.
That's still got a lot of power left to it.
It's got a lot of power left, but it's just so, it's really funny. The first film, even the second film, it's got some funny bits. The third film, you're watching it, you're like, they should just call these movies Paycheck.
Yeah.
It's Paycheck City.
But there was already a movie called Paycheck, and
that movie sucked balls. But
yeah, Transformers number three.
All right, Chris, just go for it.
Oh, I can't. We'll save that. We'll save that. Yeah. We're definitely going to be talking about that a little later on.
Okay.
Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, number four. All of these are very tight, very closely, close together.
People went and saw them.
Yeah. All the same people, yeah. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, number five.
That's good, though. I like Harry Potter.
Number
that's
six.
The first one on the list that's actually a decent sequel because it came from a decent book.
Number six is The Bourne Ultimatum.
Well, that I'm all for. I mean, I can jump up and down. I'm going to go jump outside in the sleet right now.
Well, don't hurt yourself.
I can't get out.
And if you're planning on doing that, make sure you keep the phone at your ear so we can hear it.
It's glued. I have super glue.
Number seven, 300. Number eight, Ratatouille.
Oh, that's yeah.
Number nine, I Am Legend. Actually, this is changed since I Am Legend opened from last time I read this. Number ten, The Simpsons Movie.
All right, I can go. I know. Chris, did you hate that passionately too?
What, The Simpsons Movie?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. Actually.
Okay, good. I just remember. Okay, I need to say something. We had this guy call in the middle of the summer and ask what's good tonight. Like, he's like going to a restaurant asking what should I see. Dude, Chris, you were in top four, but you said no, don't go see the Transformers. And then he mentioned the Simpsons, but I didn't know whether you like the Simpsons. You'll forgive me for not remembering.
No, we talk about a lot of movies.
It's just because I missed your presence on the show. So.
Well, I thought Simpsons was a good movie, but like a lot of TV shows that become movies, it felt a little long. So,
right.
And that's the case any time a TV show makes a movie, whether it's The X-Files or that one, it always just seems, it's like not quite as good, with the exception of South Park. It's the only
there one. You go, baby. All right.
I
loved you for a reason.
I read that there are 160 drafts of the Simpsons script.
Really?
160.
Who wrote them?
I can't imagine. Can't imagine how many people tried their hand at it. All to come up with a film that's perfectly acceptable and perfectly funny, but no more or less so than the best than a good Simpsons episode.
Right.
Yeah, definitely not as funny as the funniest. There's 30 minutes of episodes of The Simpsons that are funnier than the Simpsons movie. And
yeah.
That's, it's not a big deal. It was still enjoyable. I think anybody that goes.
Yeah, it's a good. It's a fun movie. I mean.
Yeah. But I'm surprised that anything can survive 160 writers or 160 rewrites. But if we look through here, outside of the top 10, Alvin and the Chipmunks at number 13. After this,
I didn't pay money to see that. I know a lot of people think I saw that. I didn't see that. Okay.
After this weekend, it came in number two, $142 million total.
Yeah.
It's a kids movie. I mean, family movie.
I haven't seen that, and I didn't see Underdog, but I want to know what is Jason Lee, Kevin Smith alumni, he's doing all these kids movies. What does he know that we don't know, and was there something I'm missing?
Something. It was a very successful movie, and we were talking, Jamie and I were talking to a friend of ours the other night who took his children to see it, and he said, of all the children's movies he had to see, he said he didn't think it was that bad. So,
yeah.
Well, and obviously, all right, can you put that in, perspective, that bad, compared to getting your toenails ripped off by a Wolverine? in the Siberian forest or something? Could you reiterate? I mean,
compare it to another like kids movie that's out, or family movie that's out, The Golden Compass, which no one seems to want to go see. And whether
it's
that's
okay. No, I'll say I'm sure the Alvin and Chipmunks is better than The Golden Compass. And I talked to Jamie about this. Like, we didn't mind The Golden Compass, but the main reason, we didn't read the book. So I don't know. I don't have anything to compare it to. You know, the problem with The Golden Compass is that there seems to be that there was this grand idea of a film. You know, not every great book needs to be turned into a film, but when you water down the message so much, you're like, why did you even waste the film stock?
Yeah. I'm not,
you know, you know, you have to.
I'm not sure it was a great book, actually, you know. And,
no, but why you would think that would even be, when you think about the subject matter of the book, actually, and the two books after that, like even I have to say, you know, American movie audiences aren't going to go for that.
But they, right now, I think with, you know, the success of the Lord of the Rings movies and the Harry Potter movies, they're just any sort of, they're kind of latching on to any sort of fantasy series that they can make. And
that's true.
Of, you know, obviously, this one didn't make money, so I don't think we're going to see those other Golden Compass movies.
No, I think that, only in the parallel universe. But there is one good thing about the failure of the Golden Compass. There is a silver lining. The Hobbit
okay.
is coming.
The Hobbit is coming. Well,
the Hobbit is coming.
That's going to be a very small cleanup.
It's going to be a very small cleanup, but I mean, the Hobbit, the two Hobbit movies with Peter Jackson is. I don't. He's Sam Raimi's going to direct. I guess is the thing, maybe. But that's.
Dude,
you know,
Chris
really,
just told her. Just Chris just told a really funny punchline, man.
It's one of the greatest punchlines in the history of Movie Geeks United. I don't.
There you go. Good. I'm glad I got your response from it. You know, basically, Alvin and the Chipmunks. Back to that.
I think that's your favorite movie of the year. You won't tell us that you've seen it, but I think that's
as long as it's done with a reasonable amount of competency, which I'm sure it was. It's pre-sold. I mean, it's Alvin and the Chipmunks, the first time they're computer-generated, you know, on the screen.
That would sell me, Jamie.
Name recognition, a family movie at Christmas time, it's a no-brainer. I mean, it's
yeah,
great.
It's like we had
a
guest
paycheck
on.
When you say that.
We had
so
a
what
guest
was
on
that?
A couple months ago that said, and I can't remember who it was, but they were saying there's this huge market out there for family-friendly movies.
Oh, absolutely.
There's one that comes out, right now, this movie comes out, there's not a lot of competition in the family genre. It's going to do really well. And
yeah, there's no doubt. It doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me at all. I think it's very interesting. You had all these big movies come out, like, last weekend, and the top three movies are I Am Legend, National Treasure 2, and the Alvin and Chipmunks, and you can, for two of those, National Treasure 2, and Alvin Chipmunks, you can take the whole family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. And, it has,
plus they're the movie version of comfort food, you know?
Yeah.
That's true. That's very true, Jamie.
Thank you. I'm bound to make a good point. At least
one,
no, one good point
good
to show.
You make good points all the time. Jesus Christ. I mean,
this is what I want to talk about.
So
all three of us now have seen Juno. So let's discuss. I know that, Jerry, you let your opinion known on that briefly last week. So
last week or the week before?
Yeah, let's go ahead and start with you and just expound upon your opinion on it.
Expound, that's great. You make it sound like what I had to say was important. Okay, Juno just worked on every level. I know a lot of people compare it to Little Miss like this year's Little Miss Sunshine, and that's a fair analogy. But I was talking to some people about it earlier today, and it's just the whole movie and if you watch the whole thing and the way the story evolves, it's not what I expected. It's not what I, you know, a lot of people said, oh, it's just a ripoff of Knocked Up or Waitress.
What surprised you about it?
What?
What surprised you?
The second half of the film surprised me. The relationship between her and Michael Cera and Jason Bateman's character and Jennifer Gardner's character surprised me. I didn't expect those things. When I saw it, you know, you think it's just a lot, you know, you read all these reviews before it comes out, and it's just like, I didn't expect these things. I didn't expect to be so emotionally involved in the story. Like the movie last year, the Spanish movie Volver or Little Children, I was that wrapped up in it, and I didn't expect that. And I got very wrapped up.
It's interesting, and I will say, because I also saw The Bucket List this weekend.
Which is one of the greatest movies ever made.
Right.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm just going on an assumption, because Rob Reiner would never let me down.
the bucket list is you have these two tremendous actors, and that's the appeal. Anyone that goes to see it will see it because of that. The fact of the matter is they really don't have a lot of chemistry together, and I blame it on the script. I blame it on the script because they're playing plot devices instead of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the plot devices to get the thing from point A to point B, which you know what the route that they're taking is anyway. There's not a whisper of surprise in it. However, I mean, they do have great moments. They generate great moments because, you know, they're Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson. I mean,
that's what they do is generate great moments. Like, if nothing else,
yeah,
if they don't have a great script to work with, they can do that, you know.
Yeah, and they do it. So I'm comparing this to Juno, and I'm thinking,
do you like it better than Juno?
Yeah, no. I like Juno a lot more.
Okay,
and,
I just wanted to... It's all right if you liked it the other way. That's fine. I mean...
Because I'm thinking... These characters in Juno could have easily been types, you know, the quirky types. But like you said, the second half, the turns in the characters surprise you. And I cannot think of a clear example of a movie that belongs to its writer. It is the writer's voice through and through in that movie. And it's never so... It's filled with clever dialogue. And it's never as good... and never as honest as this one moment in the movie that just floored me, where her father, after he finds out that she's pregnant, says, and she has all these smarmy, sarcastic, kind of slangy things
to say.
And her dialogue is built on that. Her father says, "I didn't think that you were the kind of girl to do this," and she, you know, in a moment of complete,
"I don't know what kind of girl I am."
I don't know what kind of girl I am yet.
It's
that was a complete. Honest moment, and I love that. And right then, I was with that character.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing is phenomenal. Jason Bateman is phenomenal. Why don't we see him in more movies? I think now we will.
I hope we will. I think his promise of like Arrested Development and even in The Kingdom. I think now we're going to begin to see him because I did not. I should have seen those things, but I didn't see those things coming from him. But.
Yeah.
Added a whole something. I didn't expect his character to do those things.
Jennifer Garner's great. The guy that plays the J.J. Jameson or whatever in Spider-Man, what's his name?
J.K. Simmons. He's wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful, Allison Janney. It's perfectly cast. Ellen Page is great.
Allison Janney's great.
I think that Ellen Page, people are talking the Oscar for her. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't think that... I think that maybe that's not going to happen.
If it were
supporting roles, it probably would. But I think that she will be nominated. But it's a great quirky film. The only complaint I have is that it feels at times, outside of that moment that I just mentioned, and some of the detour moments that these characters take, it feels kind of dislocated to me, like I find most Wes Anderson movies, you know, where I can't really get inside them. For the most part.
Well, I wanted to bring up something about Wes Anderson. Can I bring up something about Wes Anderson? Or
let's hear what Chris has to say. Yeah,
I want to hear what Chris has to say, then we'll go what I have to say about.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely lean more on Jerry's side of the argument. In fact, looking at the preview for the movie, and especially the opening 10 minutes of the movie, I started to feel like it was going to be a Wes Anderson kind of thing. Very too cutesy and too hip. And
inside joke, kind of?
Well, not so much inside, but just so the way that Wes Anderson's characters, they kind of have their own way of speaking, and it just kind of goes through the whole movie. And like Jamie's saying, you can appreciate it and you can love those movies, but you don't really get inside the characters. You don't get to experience them as real people. And Juno, I thought, started off that way in the opening 10 minutes or
mm-hmm.
so, and it really, starts that way, I think, for a reason, because once she starts to realize that this is for real, that quirkiness and over-the-top quirkiness kind of drops out, and it becomes very genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it does.
I agree.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I talked about what it became a genuine experience to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the music has a lot to do with it, too.
The music is... The soundtrack's not available, I think, till next week or the week after, but the soundtrack is wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
The songs are beautiful.
I think it made me feel opposite what the movie wanted me to feel. I thought of Harold and Maude.
That's not a bad thing, Jamie.
I love Harold and Maude because it's a black I mean, it's a very dark comedy. I like its courage. I like where it goes. But
this is not a dark comedy, though.
The whole thing with no, but I'm talking about Harold Ammon.
I know. I realize that. Thank you.
I'm talking about the Cat Stevens music in Harold Ammon.
Right.
After a while, it becomes it doesn't really let you inside. It's just a faddish kind of thing set on top of the movie for me. And I felt that way with the music. I felt like it was kind of faddish and even it was dislocated. It just didn't get me inside of the movie.
No, I have to disagree.
Disagree 100% with that.
It was too much, especially the use of the Moldy Peaches song at the end. I think that's the name of the group that sings the song. Of course, Michael Cera and Ellen Page sing it together at the end of the movie. It's played once before in the movie, and then they sing the song. They actually are on the soundtrack singing the song. And the words, they do kind of, I can see what you mean, it sort of beats you over the head with a message, but it kind of illuminates the very, exactly what works about the script in the second half of the movie.
Yeah.
Like Jerry was saying, the movie could go in a lot of different directions, and as you're watching it, you don't know which way it's going to go. You're like, is she actually going to maybe keep this baby, or is at one point she considers abortion. There's many different things that could happen in that script, and the choices that they did make were so unique and genuine, and of course it comes back around to the relationship between those two people. They're dumb, and like she says to her father, I don't know what kind of girl I am. She's too young, and they're
right.
Both too young, and they know it.
That scene at the end is beautiful.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, and
yeah.
I
was moved by the movie, and I thought that it had plenty of genuine moments, and the moments that you guys are talking about, I mean, they let me into the movie. And I do appreciate the surprises in the movie. That's why it's so different from The Bucket List that has no surprise whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Did Rob Reiner shit in your cereal?
Well, can you not see the trailer and figure that out on your own?
Well, I saw the trailer when we saw Charlie Wilson's War, and everyone was laughing, and I was just like, you know, come on, guys, don't you want to watch Blood and Wine again? But okay, that's just...
like they'd seen it the first time.
I don't think anyone...
Yeah. I want to talk about something fun. Let's talk about... not that this hasn't been fun. It's been
it's been great. This has been a very eye-opening experience.
But at least we all can say, even if we had differing opinions about the movie, we can all recommend it, I think. And
I think it's a given that we recommend.
We're all recommending it. Yeah, I think it's a nice smile of a movie, and you know, it doesn't pander. It's got genuine characters and genuine moments in it, and great performances.
And that's a great point. It doesn't pander. I think you hit it right. It does not at all.
Yeah,
it
is clearly a writer's movie. I mean, it is an original, is strong original voice that comes through in that movie.
And it's genuinely good-hearted, which is something that's just not enough genuinely good-hearted movie. Well, we compared it to Little Miss Sunshine, which is a good-hearted movie,
but it plays like a sitcom.
It doesn't seem entirely genuine. Yeah, parts it plays like a sitcom. I don't feel that this movie has that. It's very sweet and genuine.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't. We're going to bring on Aaron Anadias. He's our DVD critic. And we're going to talk about the latest DVDs, but first he's going to join us to discuss our least favorite films of the year. You know, everyone has their best of list. We're going to go through our worst of the year first. We're going to get rid of the fun stuff first.
Yeah.
Aaron, hey, how you doing?
Hey, guys, what's up?
Hey, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Aaron.
Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, cover all the bases.
All of the above.
All of the above.
Okay, how are we going to do this? Each of us has three picks.
Real quick, can I say something real quick?
Yeah,
y'all said South Park, best show into a movie. That is very good, but you left out The Fugitive.
Ah, good.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
A little bit different, but you
and
are
then
right.
It's not anime.
You are right. If we're going on technical, yeah, you're right, baby, you're right.
Okay, so worst movies of the year. We're all going to disclose our three. Let's just do it one person at a time, disclosing all three. Who do we want to start with?
You
want to start, Aaron? Go ahead.
I'll start. These are pretty bad films. I'm pretty good at navigating what I think I'll have a reaction to, but there are films I go to even though may have minimum expectations and a lot of times I'm surprised. But these were in the year of 2007, these were the three grimmest experiences I had. Number three... And I remember you guys actually like this film, made me question whether or not I should be on the show first time.
Don't worry about it.
Was Live Free or Die Hard.
Oh, well, I liked it, but I can see where you wouldn't, Aaron.
Aaron, you and I are for once in total agreement.
I think a lot of...
There's a Kodak moment.
I know a lot of people... I know we could go on and on about how, you know, it's PG-13, it doesn't have the T. Okay, that even...
That's
if
not
you're
the problem.
That even if you leave that out, that is that film was not did not live up to the spirit of John McClane. It didn't live up to the tradition of the Die Hard film. The key, one of the key things of the Die Hard film that, that this sequel did not have is that Die Hard, it's all three films are very claustrophobic and have one setting, you know, skyscraper, Manhattan Island, airport. So it's very geographic and it's put into one area. When they open it up and have it basically the whole eastern seaboard, it's just, it's not a Die Hard film. It's just a terrorist action film. And I've talked to this to other people that, I'm sorry, and even a show like 24 knows that it's not exciting, so they leave it to a minimum. But villains typing real fast at a computer, not exciting. And there's a lot of that in Live Free and Die Hard. And there's just other things, having to give them a sidekick, bringing up the daughter, it's literally a Die Hard film by spare parts, and it's just terrible. And I'm sorry, Lynn Weissman or Lee Weissman.
It was better than Perfect Stranger, though. Can't we agree on that?
No, we cannot agree. That doesn't.
No, but I mean, I'm gonna have to disagree with you here, just because at least it's Willis playing McClane. I know it's not the McClane that you love. He's not in a building or on a plane or whatever, but it's not Willis pandering to the lowest common denominator.
I felt like it was.
It did not feel like John McClane to me.
That was not John McClane. That was another character that they just happened to name John McClane, but that was not John McClane.
I disagree with you there, but
you know, I felt the same way.
Other choices, Aaron.
I felt the same way watching the preview to that, just with a shaved head. And I think we had a conversation about it. I said, that's not John McClane. What's that shaved head? That's Butch from Pulp Fiction.
Or,
and I was worried about that.
It's 12 Monkeys.
There were moments in Die Hard where I felt like he got John McClane, but it wasn't consistent like the other films.
It's hard, though, after a long lapse in between films. I'm going to give these guys the ammunition here to use against us, but I'm going to say this right now, like The Two Jakes, like The Godfather 3, like The Phantom Menace. When you have a long gap in between films, it's hard to recapture that feeling. But I'm not going to say it's the worst film of the year.
Just like those other movies you named were lesser, that's why Die Hard is. It's not an absolutely horrible movie. It would be a bad movie if it was not John McClane, if it was just, you know, Joe Schmo tries to
save
the world.
But because
it's a Die Hard movie, it's very disappointing.
I didn't even capture that character again at all.
I'm not even asking for something as original and as amazing as the original Die Hard. I'll be happy if they were to do something as crudely efficient as Die Hard 2, which I feel is underrated, actually. And because, yes, it's not as elegant as the first one, but Die Hard 2, it is a Die Hard film. Let's get real basic as a movie fan. When you cannot even use the full, you know, catchphrase that you've made famous.
Yeah.
But that was to make money.
Yeah, and you know what? It shouldn't have been done. And Willis has said in an interview that, you know, hey, you couldn't tell it was a PG. I could tell it was a PG-13 movie.
I'm with you from there. I think that Die Hard has many problems, Part 4. I think its biggest problem, though, is its villain. I think on paper, I mean, the villain's fine because it plays off of what the other three played off of. If you let me talk for a second, it plays off of what the other three played off on, which is John McClane, you know, the tough city cop going after somebody more sophisticated than he is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was played so blandly. There was not a whisper of danger in this character.
Timothy Oliphant has never been so boring. He was more menacing in either Go or even...
he was very good in Go.
Or even the Elizabeth Cuthbert film.
That Girl Next Door movie, yeah.
He's scarier than that.
I think I can forgive a lot of the movie's shortcomings if I felt, you know, good guy versus bad guy was, like, a lot stronger and more visceral in this movie.
And
like
also,
it was in the previous stuff.
But we liked it, Jamie. You and I did like this more than
I did. I thought it had effective sequences.
Yeah.
I, I thought there were moments where I felt McClane was back when he fought the Maggie Q, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm not ecstatic about it, as
it's
I was
not
about
ecstatic, but I'll take
years.
What I can get at this point summer. Yeah.
Okay, Aaron, your next choice.
Number two, and this is kind of a slight cheat, but I don't think so, because it was obviously a film that was released to qualify, but it didn't come out really until 2007. And that is Letters from Iwo Jima.
You didn't like that?
I thought it was deadly dull. I thought it was condescending.
How condescending?
I thought it was condescending in that basically the film viewpoint, political viewpoint, is that look how noble these Japanese are because they know they're going to be defeated, and that's and by them accepting defeat and death, that gives them a sense of nobility where, and to the point, they just become kind of stiff statues. And then I also, and not only does it do that, but that'd be one thing, but then it turns around and actually gets kind of bordering on pornographic violence in that one scene in the cave when they start, executing themselves. And Eastwood lingers on it, and Eastwood, who's a fine technician as a filmmaker, and I love Bridges of Madison County and A Perfect World and Unforgiven and some of the other films he directed, but when it comes to complex emotional characters and psychologically complex characters, the man does not have it. That's why Mystic River, to me, doesn't work, and this Letter from Iwo Jima didn't work. Flags of Our Fathers, I thought, while I had a lot of problems with that, was a little sturdier because it dealt more with action, and that's why I think Million Dollar Baby is a better film, because it's in a genre, and even though it thwarts the genre a little, even that thwarting is within the confines of its story. Letters of Iwo Jima is just deadly slow. Although, I will grant that Ken Watanabe gives a great performance amidst all this stiltedness.
Well, I have to disagree with you there about Eastwood and complexity. If you've ever seen Play Misty for Me and High Plains Drifter, then I really...
Play Misty for Me is just—it's a very straight. It's a great film. It's a great.
Great. No, it's a great film, but not only that. I think your Letters from Iwo Jima. I don't feel that at all. I think he made these two very, the Flags of Our Fathers and Letters to Iwo Jima taken together, the Iwo Jima saga, are the most cynical war films I've seen from a mainstream director since Samuel Fuller.
Oh, I would.
And even Dalton Trumbo's, maybe even Dalton Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun. But I have to disagree with you there.
There's a lot of talk on the chat room here.
I don't think you can I don't think you can get more cynical than obviously Johnny Got His Gun or Stanley Kubrick Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, but Flags of Our Fathers, these are very cynical films. These are not patriotic on either side.
Cynical moments in Flags. The best moment in Flags of Our Fathers
is Adam Beach.
No, he's terrific, but the best moment. And I was like, oh wow, this is really going to get into it. Is when when the man falls overboard, and they don't stop. And the guy says, well, so much for no man left behind.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's early on. I was like, wow, we're going to get a bunch of this stuff, but we never get anything really.
Well, you get that stateside. You get a lot of that stateside, Aaron.
In terms of complexity for Clint Eastwood, I think that he reached a stage when he did Unforgiven. Where he no longer saw things as black and white, where he saw the shades of gray. I think I see that a lot.
I see that time and
in his
time
later
again.
Work. That being said, I think that he's not the kind of filmmaker that I would automatically give two World War II epics to. He seems like a very laid back kind of director. It doesn't seem.
The reason why
doesn't seem like the fire or the I don't know how to explain it. I didn't see either one.
Okay, well, thank you, Jamie, for that honesty right there.
But I could tell from the little I saw of I tried to watch Flags of Our Fathers, I tried to watch some of Iwo Jima. I can kind of see Aaron's point about the deathly doll.
And the thing about
did you like Cross of Iron, Aaron?
Cross of Iron is great.
Under the Flag of the Rising Sun?
You know, I love a lot of war and Western films, but these two weren't the pinnacle.
Oh no, dull is not the word I'd use. But okay, let's go to number three.
Did you like Red Dawn, Eric?
Did you like Red Dawn? Did you like Did you like Don Cheesy Saves the World? Did you like Taboo American Style?
Red Dawn.
All right, Aaron, your third choice. We can go on. Somebody in the chat room wants to know if we'd like to remake Silver Bullet. Probably
if
not.
The Coors Beer Wolf is in it, fuck yeah.
Hey, Silver Bullet, that's a great Gary Busey performance. I'm sorry. Silver
Even
Bullet.
More,
yes,
more so
yes,
than
yes.
Eye of the Tiger?
Yes, okay. My number one, and you think I'm going to... And guys, I just want to say, I'm not doing this. I swear, I am not doing this to be contrarian or or create some kind of...
Oh, drama. My God, he knows his own hype. I love this guy.
Okay, I swear I'm not doing it. So please take my word, and I'm not doing this.
I take your word, baby. I take your word. Go for it.
But the worst film I saw in 2007 was, and after the scream I'll explain, was Redacted.
Okay. You'll have no argument from me there.
Okay. I just, there's a slight cheat in that I don't have a Landmark Theater in San Antonio, Texas, but I do have, on demand. So I saw it on demand.
Son of a bitch.
So I saw it on demand, so I saw it, and here's two things. I cannot even discuss the film on a political level because the quote-unquote improv naturalistic acting is so horrendous that I cannot even accept the characters. So therefore, I refuse to even discuss the film on a political level. And an extension of that is that you take away the credit directed by Brian De Palma, all these reviews that came out trying to struggle with the film and make sense of it and make sense of it how it fits in De Palma's canon, same critics, they wouldn't have given two thoughts to this film.
True.
It's a terrible film. Directors make bad films. This is one of the flaws, some people will say in the auteur theory that you must consider every director's film, every director's piece of work. I say you don't have to. If it's awful, you just, hey, they messed up. And here's the sad thing is that the approach to it is not only is it a brilliant approach, this whole getting information through other forms of media, it's actually an approach that fits De Palma, of this guy that the limits of technology has been a key theme to all of his films, most of his films. But the problem with Redacted is, even though it's supposed to be all rough and tumble and gritty, even in the editing of this so-called found footage is too smooth. And it's smooth, so smooth that we get all the information that we need. There should be some holes in the story where we have to fill in because parts of the footage is missing. And I know critics like to pretend the film didn't exist, but the best example of that type of editing is still Blair Witch Project, where the editing in that, there were times when you're like, well, what happened? What happened? And you almost have to infer a plot point because it wasn't caught on camera. You don't have to infer anything about Redacted, but the acting is so atrocious, particularly that Chris Farley lookalike guy. It's just... It was a chore to sit through it, and the movie's not even
It's not a chore, but can I say something?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I think what I objected to the film is that it, I read this book of interviews with Brian De Palma during the summer, and he went after Kubrick for breaking the conventions of the horror genre with The Shining. Meanwhile, I'm watching the film with my parents and my brother walked out. And I have to say, the film just reminds me so much of Kubrick's Paths of Glory at times, Full Metal Jacket, Barry Lyndon, but it also reminds me of his hero Godard's film, Night Music, that came out a couple of years ago. I don't think it's a bad movie, but what I appreciate of the film, and I've talked to Jamie about this before, I appreciate De Palma's rage. I appreciate that more than anything else. His rage. I wish his rage was more in the film than what I saw.
I love a good angry screed by a filmmaker that's just go for broke, but if it just comes out as hot air, then they're annoying. I think a better film made in anger, different topic, but politically charged, is actually Fahrenheit 9/11. That's a better film of a filmmaker who'd made a film out of anger, because they've harnessed that anger into what they want to say. I don't think, honestly, as much as De Palma articulates what his point is, I don't think he knows what he wants to say. about the war. All
I think he wants to say the war's first casualty is humanity, and we're raping
well,
the country and look what this is causing. Look at the turmoil that this is causing our young people that we're not going to be rid of for the next 50 years. I think it's clear what he's trying to say. I think the merits of the film, its approach, its acting, I mean, that's up for grabs.
Yeah.
But the one problem I find
rage, I think, can't be denied, though.
One problem I find with Redacted, I'm sorry, Chris, let's let Chris talk for a second.
Please, Chris, talk.
Oh, no, I couldn't completely disagree with everything that you've said. I actually did not. I know a lot of people said what you have said about the acting. I didn't find that to be true, actually. I will say that the one scene outside the barracks, the security camera, I think those scenes probably could have been gotten rid of, and it might have had the effect you're talking about as far as leaving some plot points out, because those scenes don't work on many different levels, including the acting. Other than that scene, I actually found the acting to be very... Because when people know that there's a camera on, we see this on reality TV, especially, you know, like guys in the military, they're not on film a whole lot, so if someone does bring a camera around, people have a tendency to sort of elevate their personality and become very animated and sort of ridiculous.
It's funny.
Camera.
You even see it in a group of guys where that happens when you're trying to play more macho than you actually are.
Yeah.
I brought it up to someone. To me, there's a big difference between amateurs acting, which I consider like Redacted, and then non-professional, naturalistic acting, where they're doing things that actors wouldn't do, but they're little, you know, things that call attention to themselves, but they're doing it in such a natural way that you realize, oh, it's sort of a tick of theirs. And a good example, if you want to look at where I don't mind a naturalistic, unprofessional acting, is either Wiley Wiggins in Dazed and Confused, the young kid.
Right.
He's gotten a lot of crap for his mannerisms, but mm-hmm. to me they were the mannerisms of a 14-year-old kid, even though probably a 14-year-old actor wouldn't do them. And here's one you will laugh at. I don't mind, I hate his other films, but I don't mind the kind of non-professional mannerisms of Prince in Purple Rain.
God, we're
okay.
Right. If you want to look at the non-professional actors, I mean, look no further than the peripheral characters in every film Duvall has directed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think we're talking about people that don't know how to behave. They're putting on a front. They're people that don't know their place in the world, their place in where they are in Iraq. I bought the acting, and Chris did too. I think the one fault of Redacted is that it has a limited shelf life. I think it's outdated next year.
That's true. I would actually think that really the only thing that's really limited life.
But I think that's its strength too, because its strength is that it's so urgent.
It's urgent, but it's. You know, it does.
Look
you said it's a shelf life. You hit it right on the head, Jamie.
But look at Fahrenheit 9/11. That has a limited shelf life, but yet I can still watch it, and there is still some value in it, I think. And I will say this real quick: Morris Day is an underrated comic actor.
Okay.
All right, Jerry.
Let's get your
three worst, and then we'll get Chris's, and then we'll get mine because we always save
the
best for last.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just gonna go with some shit here. I wouldn't put Redacted as my worst. I have problems with it, but. Jamie, you and I talked about this. You recorded the conversation to use against me later. Okay, my three worst are Dead Silence, Premonition, Next, Rendition, and, yeah, I'm just going to go with four because they really blew chunks.
Okay. Now, are there any themes here, anything that you want to discuss?
I don't like Dead Silence, I was just, you know, killer puppet dolls or whatever, but I just didn't. I told you, I went to go see that in Premonition the same day. I was like, come on, don't play us cheap like that. You know, come on. I got this horror movie, then I got this other one with Sandy Bullock, whatever the hell her name is, you know, a Lifetime movie, which has some twist in it. It's about, you know, you're watching it, you're like, oh, come on, give me a break.
I will say that I didn't go see Premonition because I knew it was probably going to be not a very good one, although I am tempted to, like, buy it on demand. Just so I can see, okay, what is the actual answer to the mystery? But
yeah.
I don't know if
you
I want
to... You Chris. I mean, Aaron, just watch something on Skinamax at 2 in the morning. It's more entertaining.
I had a premonition that I wouldn't like the movie, so I never got it.
Well, that's your... Jamie, I wish I had that premonition.
Busted Cups 2 is great.
Next with Nicolas Cage is based on a Philip K. Dick story, and it's directed by a director who made Once Were Warriors, and
right.
and it's just good stuff. But this film was the second half of the movie. You're like, what's the point? It's it doesn't.
And he made the best Brosnan Bond film.
And which Die Another Day?
Of the four Brosnans?
Oh God, I'd rather back and watch.
It gets back to the cheesiness, greatness of the Bond film. Now, granted, I prefer the new Bond with Dennis.
Oh yeah,
but if we had to go back to the Roger Moore, Octopussy level Spy Who Loved Me, I'd prefer Die Another Day to the more glum World Is Not Enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess.
My favorite is Tomorrow Never Dies among the Brosnan. I like
that car chase, that BMW. I wish I had that BMW. Can we go to someone else now, please?
We wish you had that BMW.
Okay, so you're done talking about your worst of the year.
I don't really have it. And can I say something about Rendition, though, and also some of the other political films? And it's just, they're very insulting to one's intelligence, these films that have come out. These are issues that people go in to see these films, know the issues, they know the history behind the issues, they don't like being condescended to, they don't like being preached to, and they don't like the material being written by people that don't know what's going on.
We have two people in the chat room, or we have two people in the chat room, we have more than that, but we have, for people just joining us in the chat room, we're talking about the worst films of the year, and Anthony came up with
he
a couple.
He hates Reno 911.
He hits Reno 911 and War.
With Jet Li,
War's not. It's not as good as Crank, but I kind of liked War. But I will say this about Rendition: my biggest complaint about Rendition is not so much the obviousness of the story, but they throw in a kind of time lapse twist,
like Babel,
that makes no sense. And I literally spent about 4 minutes missing the film because I'm trying to put the timeline together. And
true,
I don't think. And even at the end, I'm not sure if I got the timeline correct.
I have to say, I don't think I got it right either.
Thought it was clever. You think it's clever for like 30 seconds, and then you're like, well, wait a minute.
Chris, give us your bottom three of the year, so to speak.
Okay. First of all, I want to say that Pulp Fiction started that whole nonlinear thing. It wasn't the first movie to do it, but that has become so prevalent since that movie.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think, other than Memento, has never been used effectively since then.
True.
Well,
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead does it pretty well.
It does it very well.
And Exotica? And Exotica?
Exotica does it well, too. That's true. Yeah. But Chris, please, enlighten
me. Okay. Number three for me is I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry.
No argument there.
I mean, it's just so embarrassing. First of all, I'm not a big Adam Sandler fan in the first place, and it's just... it's just upsetting how stereotypical the movie is and how truly offensive it is. And I'm not a gay person, but it's just as a human being and someone that supports gay rights, this movie is just embarrassing and offensive. And I just don't understand how people can sit through it and laugh. Doesn't make sense.
Has anyone asked any of their gay friends if they've seen it?
No, I haven't.
Because I don't want to get beaten up.
No,
friends?
I don't want to get beaten up by... I don't want them to say, hey, why would you say that? I mean, why would you think we'd want to go see that piece of shit?
Yeah.
I think that it's something to be said for bearing 2 hours, 75% of your movie wallowing in those stereotypes, and then the last 15 minutes saying, but we all should really join together. You know, we really should all look beyond that. It's like a cop-out, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's more honest homoeroticism on this show than in that movie.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly feel it. Okay, go ahead,
I'm going to write a book about it after we get off the air tonight.
Go ahead, Chris.
All right, number two, Transformers. I'm sorry.
I knew that was coming. You wanted to do that. You wanted to just jag that right into my jugular.
I can't even say that the movie doesn't accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish, because it does, and people that want to see an action movie are going to enjoy it, but it's a fucking children's movie. The movie is it's from a children's show, and they made a children's movie. And, I tried to sit through it a second time. I actually...
Wait, you went to go see it twice?
No. I saw it in the theater, and then at Christmas, my family sat around, and they decided to put that movie in.
Oh, God, you must have been in hell.
Yeah, you know, but I said, okay, well, let me sit with, you know, my girlfriend and her family and see if maybe watching it with some, you know, the people that I love and seeing their enjoyment, maybe I can just sit and enjoy this movie, and I couldn't. It was worse the second time. There's just nothing there.
Okay, that's valid, though, Chris. I understand that. I mean, I totally understand that.
Yeah, I gave it 3 because it does what it does. And it is probably the perfect melding of director and material. It's what Michael Bay does. It's better than The Island. And I must say the final battle between the two robots and this big, and they destroy the skyscrapers, I must say that is, on a technical level, pretty exciting. And I might get some hate mail on this. I'm actually a big Shia LaBeouf fan. I think he's charming. I think he's pretty funny.
I agree with you 100%. If there's one thing about the movie that does work, I think it is Shia LaBeouf. However, I have to disagree with you about the action sequence at the end. There's so much going on, and it's so frenetic that you can't see what's happening, and it's annoying.
Can we all agree that Michael Bay's best film, though, is Bad Boys 2?
I actually truly like Bad Boys 1. I think it's a pretty good movie.
I like both Bad Boys films, actually.
I also have to disagree with you about The Island. While it's not a perfect movie, it's definitely flawed, and I can't even say, you know, on a scale of 5, I don't even know if I would give it a 3. However, at least the movie has some themes, some ideas in it. They're not beautifully drawn out, but they are there. Transformers has nothing on that level.
But Michael Bay has no idea what an idea is.
I mean, stop the press.
See, Transformers, I think what you're saying, Chris, is Transformers, all it really amounts up to is 2.5 hours
Boy sales.
Of nauseating eye candy.
Yes.
There's no there.
That's a fair assessment. I understand that. I mean, I'm not going to say, oh, Chris, you're evil. No, I understand that completely. Because I didn't expect
Spielberg has made his share of mechanical wind-up toy movies before, but they always have a soul. There's always an entry in there.
There was a soul in Goonies?
Hey, don't cut on the Goonies, dude. You're going to get so much hate mail from the chat room. It's not even funny.
So, okay, Chris, so Transformers is your second pick?
Transformers is my second pick. Number one, I'm going to kind of do what Aaron did. I don't think it's an absolutely horrible movie, but from the point of view of a fan of this director's movies, it was such a big disappointment, and the worst thing I can say about it is that as time has gone on, it's only gotten more upsetting for me. David Lynch's Inland Empire.
Wow, is the
worst movie of 2007.
I would have put it on my list, but I refused to see it.
I'm sorry.
I don't even know what the film is about. Can I be honest with you? I don't even know what didn't you like about it?
Well, what I didn't like about it is exactly what you just said. I don't know what the film is about. But what's more upsetting than that is I truly don't think that David Lynch knows what the film is about. And people have said that about his films for a long time, and I've never thought it was true. With every movie he's made before this, even though there's elements of the movie that I don't understand, the movies have a central theme and a central story that seems like it was thought out beforehand. This movie is not not present in this movie.
I just gained so much respect for you.
It feels like an experiment that's gone wrong. I almost equate the movie to like when a really good band puts out a B-sides album because they don't have any new material. That's what the movie feels like to me. It feels like David Lynch B-sides.
It's like Adams' album.
That's a good point. No, but I have to say something. And this is a really bold pick of yours, Chris, because I don't know what the film's about. I like it because I like Lynch. I'll be very honest with you. My admiration for Lynch, though, is more from high school and college. I haven't kept up really with his ethos of his personality, but I have to say I respect that choice.
You have
no idea how much I respect your choice.
Well, I don't think he explored anything new as a director, and that's really upsetting.
Do you think it was a parody of a David Lynch film?
It really does feel like
it started
else
to play like
trying,
that, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. And also, it's just too long. It would have been one thing if they'd have cut it down, because it does have some scenes that are strangely effective in a very David Lynch kind of way. But again,
particularly in the beginning.
There's no central theme, no central story that's being told.
I was with it at the beginning, weren't you, Chris?
Oh, yeah. I was with it up until the first hour, and I think that there was a theme that was being explored, and there were some very central ideas that were being sought out. But we all know how this movie was made, and he has said that this movie was, you know, it's sort of made on the fly, and I really don't think there was a script there. I don't think there was anything that was there was no point.
And Chris, I think you're like me when you're not heartened by the idea that Lynch no longer wants to work on any format except HD,
well,
because his movies are so visual and so like immersive an atmosphere, and I don't
exactly.
Like
and
the
like
TV.
I said before, it's disappointing because as a director, you know, a director can make a bad movie. Like Aaron was saying, he didn't like Sands of Iwo Jima and
Letters from Iwo Jima.
Sorry.
Okay.
John Wayne kicks ass, yo.
Yeah, but and I kind of agreed with you to a certain extent on that. And another one that it reminds me of is Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain, which I didn't really care for. I thought it was not a great movie. However, it did. I did think about it, and even you could say that it was a technically beautiful movie, and I still didn't like the movie. But I could think about it for a couple weeks after, and maybe try and explore some of the ideas in it, and still say, well, I didn't like it. David Lynch's Inland Empire doesn't have that. As soon as you see it, you start forgetting it, and it only gets less and less in my memory.
And the reason why I say it was, one, when I saw just a couple of scenes from it, like on TV or on the internet, he's using HD, and he said he's going to stay with HD, then he needs to get a real cinematographer because it's some of the worst-looking HD ever, and if he's going to keep doing it that way, I'm not going to be going to a lot of David Lynch films.
I agree 100%. That's my feeling about it.
He needs to hook up with, Michael Mann or David Fincher, and they can tell him how to do an HD camera. And the other thing, and this is just a pet peeve of mine, I have very little patience for these experimental films that are, one, the director refuses to tell you what it's about. Okay, that's fine. I can figure it out on my own. But when they're purposely just throwing stuff and seeing what sticks and there's nothing that connects it from A to B, I lose total pace. As a counterexample to Inland Empire, I'm a huge Mulholland Drive fan.
I am too. I agree.
Even though, and the reason why I stick with that film because 2/3 is a setup and it's very exciting and very intriguing. And then once it goes through the rabbit hole and it starts toying and playing little games, it has me so hooked that I can go with its more ambiguous things, and I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt.
I have a theory about that movie. We don't have time to go into it right now. But the rabbit hole part makes sense to me, but I'm not going to go into it. However, I
don't have the time.
But the thing about Inland Empire, and the thing about, because you say it has moments, that's the thing. David Lynch's bad films always have great moments, but they never have sustaining moments. I think of a movie like Lost Highway, which I really can't stand. But because for similar reasons of Inland Empire, because it makes really no sense. But there are great moments. I still love the scene where Patricia Arquette and Balthazar Getty make eye contact in slow motion to Lou Reed's cover of This Magic Moment.
In the car shop. Right.
That's a great moment. But there's
really
nothing
is.
Before it. There's nothing after it that sustains that. And same thing happened with, I think, Inland Empire. I kept hearing about how there's a great moment where he uses Nina Simone's Sinner Man, which is one of my all-time favorite songs. But then again, I kept thinking, why is David Lynch recycling a Nina Simone song that the Thomas Crown Affair owns? You know, the Pierce Brosnan film owns the use of Sinner Man. It shouldn't be used anymore.
I think the only consistent David Lynch movie, and this is coming from obviously my top movie is Wild at Heart, but it's Blue Velvet. I think if you're talking about a movie that transcends just its moments and it feels like a whole, I think Blue Velvet is.
Yeah, Blue Velvet's the one.
Blue Velvet, and I will go two more. I will grant you Blue Velvet, and I will raise you actually Elephant Man.
Oh, Elephant Man.
And the Straight Story.
Yeah.
And the Straight Story is is perfect.
But I like Lost Highway a lot too, though. But I like Barry Gifford a lot, and I like when he and Lynch work together. So
I do.
So let's talk about
agree with you.
Let's talk about my three.
I love Rammstein. Go ahead.
Okay, my three. We've talked about one, Wild Hogs. I think, like Chris's take on the Transformers, it's lowest common denominator. And as I've expressed to you guys before, it feels like when I watch Wild Hogs, I can see the executive meeting behind greenlighting Wild Hogs. You know, they might as well have filmed that. You know, let's get all the demographics in the theater.
The boomers.
So, yeah, exactly.
Boomers.
Martin Lawrence, Travolta, William Macy, Tim Allen. You know, let's get them all packed into the same theater. This is a moneymaker. And they didn't put as much thought into what would make the film surprising, and
right.
City Slickers was a much better. It was a actually elegant compared to Wild Hogs, and I'm a City Slickers fan. The first.
Okay,
yeah.
What's your second one?
Heartbreak Kid.
Bad.
Completely misjudged movie from the get-go. First of all, not funny. Secondly, a lead character that you truly just don't like.
You
I mean
Charles Grodin.
Yes, as written and played by Ben Stiller, who normally you have tremendous sympathy for, even when he does very questionable things, which is the basis of his comedy most of the time.
Right.
He's just completely detestable in this movie, and so none of the laughs like pay off as a result. And there's some shocking kind of. It feels like the Farrelly brothers. So many other filmmakers have caught up to them now. They're shock comedy, and it seems like they seem so desperate to regain it, and it doesn't come across
right.
As something that really belongs in the design of the movie. You know. So those are two there, and I had another one in mind. Give me a second. Oh, Blind Ambition.
Dude, maybe Jessica Simpson. Crucify Jessica Simpson.
The remake of Working Girl with Jessica Simpson and Luke Wilson seemed like something.
Luke Wilson's
up.
In it?
Yeah, he is. He is.
Oh my God!
But he doesn't even behave like he knows he's in it. it looks like it was shot in a week with let's patch together these different scripts.
Now we know why Owen Wilson was depressed.
Penelope and Miller, Andy Dick, all this kind of
Miller's in it.
It's terrible. Yes.
Wow.
I want to make a point on Wild Hogs, and that the I thought about putting it on my list, but I realized, you know what? To me, it was a little more benign. And actually, I did laugh with the Ray Liotta character.
I feel that way about Blonde Ambition. I mean, nobody expects that to be even a decent movie. But with Wild Hogs, look at the caliber of talent in that movie
I know,
and how wasted it is.
I tell you what really depressed me is that Wild Hogs came out opening day as Zodiac, and it just. That,
yeah.
You know, I didn't expect Zodiac to do Wild Hog numbers, but I did expect Zodiac. I was hoping for at least the game type numbers, maybe even Panic Room numbers at its best. But so Wild Hogs is trumping a Zodiac.
Right.
To give you a sense of how bad I think Wild Hogs is, I laughed out loud twice in Norbit. I didn't even bother to crack a smile in Wild Hogs.
Norbit is a failed. Ambition. I give Eddie Murphy credit for trying something totally new. It wasn't successful.
Yeah.
Those are good choices, Jamie. I just surprised you picked Blonde Ambition. I'm talking about kicking someone when they're down.
I'm just surprised that you bought.
I think it's a wake up call. I think it's a call. Don't make movies. You know, it's my begging to her. Stop trying to be everything, you know.
Well, now she wants to remake Pretty Woman. That's the next one she's got.
She's remaking Private Benjamin, and, you know.
She's not remaking Private Benjamin, is she?
Major movie star. That's another one that's coming direct to DVD.
And I actually, I will say that I actually liked, in a goofy, low-rent, cheap way, and I mean that as a compliment, I thought it was, you know, kind of dumb fun. I actually liked the Dukes of Hazzard film. I think she's funny in it. She does what the character is supposed to do.
I like
she
the guy
make
who
any
grew up before the movie started.
She doesn't even show her cleavage in this movie. It's worthless.
Oh,
all
my
right.
God. Heavens to Betsy.
Let's get some of these DVDs out of the way real quick in the last half hour of our show. We got a lot to talk about on the DVD front. Starting with television, right? We got some television box sets.
Television. And I will say this. I love HBO. HBO is my favorite network. They do some of the best shows. Yes, they're in a transitional phase, but you know what? If ever a great network deserves the benefit of the doubt during transitional phase, HBO's the one. But the one place I think they fall short is their DVD packaging. You would figure a network of this top quality would go really all out when it comes to some commentaries and some documentaries, and they rarely fit the bill. Put the bill for that, and so, so we got season 2 box of Big Love, which is really when the show came into its own. So it's terrific, but there's nothing in the way of extras except for one featurette. I mean, that's a very I would have loved a featurette interview with David Byrne, whose music on the Big
sure.
Love, that would have been fun. Give me that. Give me at least 4 commentaries. One episode of disc, but. Nothing like that, So
I will say the Big Love. Mm-hmm. Big Love is my favorite show on TV. The star of the box set is the actual series, but you're absolutely right. When you have that caliber of cast and you have David Byrne, you have Tom Hanks executive producing, and you don't offer anything in the way of commentaries or anything behind-the-scenes featurettes, really. They have three little prologue scenes that kind of cover when each of these three women entered the family that wasn't in the regular season. And that's interesting, but all told, it's like a total of maybe 12 minutes footage. It feels like a waste.
Yeah, at the very least, give us a featurette on how do you film sex scenes. You know, because obviously, if you watch the show, all three women have different techniques. That's all.
Yeah, that's a great point. But anyway,
from anyone?
It's a great quality show.
It is,
and I think Chris, you think the same way? I mean, we love Big Love.
I do love Big Love. However, I can maybe sort of understand the idea that there is no commentary behind the show because technically, like you were saying, what works about the show is the acting and the writing. So I'm not sure that really there would be a whole lot to say in commentary that would be terribly informative. Now, more special features, more featurettes, things like that. I would very much like to see something like that. But you know, there's not a lot of technical aspects to the show that need any further explanation. You know,
I think just in terms of story, it seems like in this season, they treated it like it was their last, which it's not. I think it's been picked up. But you know, they say, okay, what's every possible thing that could go wrong with this family? And it really feels like they pile it on the season, almost an overkill. But somehow it all turns out right. You know, some subplots that you think are going to derail the whole thing,
and
they end up tying them up right at the perfect time.
Mm-hmm. And anyone,
in terms of story, I'd be interested in all these different things that they wanted to explore and if they felt like it was a balancing act, like it was too much at times.
I'm really hoping
like
that they...
And there's plenty of stuff to talk about with the subject matter itself, polygamy, you know, how they wanted to approach, what research they did, anything like that. I mean, we don't get any of that.
I'm hoping that they give Bill Paxton more of a chance to direct some episodes, because ever since he made Frailty, I've been really excited about him making another movie, because that's
a good movie.
Very underrated actor's debut as a director,
mm-hmm.
and so hopefully he'll get a chance to sort of cut his teeth doing some more of those episodes before.
Yeah, he's really come into his own as an actor, and he's perfect
for
this role.
He's a terrific director. Anyone and a terrific commentator. Anyone who's heard the Frailty commentary or even the Aliens commentary, he's a lot of fun. Although he did direct the second feature, which was the Shia LaBeouf golf film.
Frailty, yeah.
Yeah. At the very least, get a commentary by Mitt Romney.
That's right, dude. The Mitt Romney commentary and the underwear doc, you know, everything.
Yeah. Okay, so The Big Love, we both agree, great show. The star of the DVD is the show itself. We're just disappointed that there are no extras. So if you love the show, buy it. You know, if you're curious about the show, pick it up, but we're wanting something more above and beyond.
You will not be disappointed. You will not be disappointed if you do buy it. It's the show is worth the price.
Yes.
Sounds good to me.
Gene Triplehorn is truly amazing.
Next up is The Wire.
The Wire, fourth
season
of The Wire. This really should sell itself by this point.
It should.
It should sell itself by this point. You know, The Wire is The Wire, and at this point, if you're not into The Wire, then, to a certain extent, I really don't want to know you.
Well, that's a cold-blooded thing to say. Not everyone has HBO. I mean,
but no. You know, you can rent it or anything. You know, I can understand if you can't afford HBO and you know that's fine. But if you like have tried to watch The Wire and say, I don't get it, I don't want to know you. Same thing with
home.
You don't hear a lot of talk about it. Like for some reason, like the show. I'll admit, I have never seen The Wire. But I don't know a lot of people that have watched it, and I know plenty of people that watch a lot of TV and a lot of HBO, a lot of DVDs. But for some reason, as much as critically acclaimed as the show is, and it does have a following,
yeah,
it hasn't caught on. I don't understand why that is.
I kind of understand it now that I've watched
it. I do understand it.
I didn't watch the show the first three seasons. I watched the season four because it arrived. It is a stellar show. I can't think of a better show. And its ambitions are just out of the water. I mean, it just from its depiction of how the government works in Baltimore to the slums and the streets of Baltimore. It has a real panoramic view of that area of Baltimore. I think it's very ambitious. It's well written. It's well acted. Everything that you expect from an HBO show. I don't think its rewards are as broad as a Sopranos. I think that they're very, very subtle. I think you really have to have patience, and you really have to follow the show, because you're not going to get the cliffhanger like you get with The Sopranos. It's not a melodrama like that. It's like real day-to-day lives on the streets, you know, and government kind of working behind the scenes and all the different million different compromises you have to make. That's what it's about. And dramatically it pays off in its little rewards and little moments, but it's not like it's not a who gets shot this week kind of Sopranos kind of thing.
It's a show meant, I mean, it's probably why it's limited in its appeal. It's a show meant for and designed by intelligent people.
And
the same thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And the same thing about The Sopranos. I think the first three seasons, The Sopranos' appeal was its grittiness and its violence. But I've always made the case that after the third season, David Chase kind of like, you know what, people are getting a little too bloodthirsty. So I'm going to comment on that, and I'm going to just do the garroting sparingly. And that's why I think the Sopranos series finale, which I think is one of the best things I saw all year, movie or television, and it really illustrated the people who are intelligent and the rest of the people, because if you were intelligent enough, you got the point of what he was getting with that family. And if you weren't intelligent enough, the next morning you were like, what's with the whole thing where she couldn't park? I got a lot of, and I just, you know, there's a lot of family members I don't talk to now.
Yeah. That's tragic. But anyway, back to The Wire. The Wire is a great show. You need to give it a chance, and actually this DVD box set is a good way to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't seen the previous three seasons. I was fine with just viewing the fourth, and I got into it just fine. They're vividly drawn characters. You don't necessarily have to know how they relate to one another from the previous three seasons. It's all there in the fourth season. It's nicely self-contained for a first-time viewer. And the DVD extras are there. They have commentary on many of the episodes, so you can get a sense of how they shot it, the relationships.
This is an example of how HBO should do all of the episodes, basically.
Yes. And kudos to HBO, because it's entering its fifth and final season next month, and they've kept it on for 5 years because they recognize its cultural importance and its
cultural
quality.
Importance, and I think they are smart enough, and where they weren't this insightful with Deadwood, I think they know that, you know, 10 years down the line, people are still going to be discovering The Wire, and it's still going to have a shelf life. People are still going to be buying it. It's going to be one of those things that gets passed down. I think that would have been the case with Deadwood also, but I think maybe the show is just too expensive for them to, you know, have that 10-year investment. But
Let's go to some movies now, because we have like 15 minutes. And I also want to plug tonight at 8 o'clock on Blog Talk Radio. You'll see the link to it on the homepage. They're having the Best of 2007, where they'll play clips from the best shows on Blog Talk Radio throughout the year. And I'm going to be listening. I'm hoping that we're on it somewhere.
I'm sure we're on it.
We better be. I'm going to be like a watchdog. I'll listen for you guys. But
the two Fox titles that are coming out, when is it?
January 8th.
January 8th. So this is really early. One is a small independent film that hit at Sundance that I really liked quite a bit. It's called Joshua. Very good. It's very effective. And it's actually I saw it really as a really black comedy about knowing you're a bad parent. And I really thought it was very effective that way. And actually knowing you're a bad parent and knowing you're a neglectful parent and it's not because that your child is actually more intelligent than you. And there's a sense that these parents, played by Vera Farmiga and Sam Rockwell, know that their child is actually probably smarter than them and savvier than them, and he gets very angry knowing that they don't even know what a gifted child they have.
Right.
It's very funny, and it's very creepy. And as these bad seed movies go, it's one of the better ones. I have quibbles with some of its kind of shorthand philosophy, because they make a point of saying that the child isn't baptized and all that kind of stuff. And then basically the film says that the child needed to be, if the child was baptized, he might not have been this way. Okay, that's interesting. But then they go and make the grandmother into a two-dimensional Christian freak, so you really can't have it both ways. You cannot have it where the film says the child needed to be baptized, but then have the grandmother be a two-dimensional villain.
Right.
I agree with everything you said, but it does seem like taking a genre, a film, the Bad Seed genre, something that's, you know, always played kind of silly and kind of creepy just because it's a child committing, you know, patricide or something.
I always like that, trying
to elevate it, and yet it feels like that same movie in fancier clothes, you know.
It is. I mean, you can have different versions. I mean, Bad Seed is limited because it was just a bad kid, where if you look at, you know, The Omen, okay, you got the devil. The Good Son is kind of a down-and-dirty exploitation version, which I'm actually a fan of. I like The Good Son quite a bit. And here is kind of a more restrained, serene type take on. I will want to make this one cultural observation, and I'll probably get some hate mail in the chat rooms, but whatever. Has anyone ever noticed that these Bad Seed movies always take place in affluent white households?
Mm-hmm.
Which I just find hysterical. I would love to see a Bad Seed type.
Well, yeah, if it were any other way, you'd just be a victim of your environment.
That, or, well, if you were even in a middle-class, you know, Mexican-American family like me, you know, this whole, you know, all of a sudden showing up in a doorway scaring your parents, you know, Mexican-American parents don't put up with that shit. That's just a cultural insight.
Let's play this little clip. This is a clip of George Ratliff, the director of Joshua. He's talking about his motives for writing Joshua and what inspired the idea, what it's similar to in his mind.
Yeah, I feel like after all these slasher movies, it'd be fun to do something with a little more meat on its bones, off the bone. But, this is the funny thing is that this movie is much more akin to, like, With a Friend Like Harry or Read My Lips or Cachet or the Beat My Heart Skip, these sort of thrillers that are steeped in naturalism rather than, you know, supernatural.
Yeah, stylistically, we were talking about the cinematography a little bit ago. What were you trying to achieve?
Well, I think I threw out some movies that I really liked and were a big influence on this, like and they were mostly French or European films, and there's a coldness to them that I think is amazing. But what we did on Joshua is that the movie sort of degrades as the look of the film degrades, sort of as Brad's character sort of unravels, and the movie begins, it's sort of cool in tone, but it's long lenses so people look nice, and it's kind of a smooth handheld where it's kind of a living frame. But as the movie progresses and Joshua takes over, the angle gets lower and lower, and the lenses get wider and wider, and so it gets, and the moves become no more handheld but more precise or locked down. And so a feeling sort of takes over the look of the movie, but also we employ a bleach bypass that's progressive. And
oh, really?
What a bleach bypass is, basically you skip one of the baths and the fixers of the actual film print.
Mm-hmm.
And what that creates is a less saturated and more contrasty look, a starker look.
Absolutely.
And so Reel 1 we did nothing to. Reels 2, 3, and 4 we did a half of a skip bleach bypass, so it's a bit less saturated, a bit more contrasting. And Reels 5 and 6, we did a full skip. So if you looked at the beginning and end of the movie, they look like totally different films. But as you're watching it, it's such a subtle thing that comes upon the movie, you don't notice that it's happening.
Okay, that was George Ratliff talking about the style and inspirations of the movie. Do we recommend the DVD?
I do recommend I believe it's his commentary and some other deleted scenes, and it's
the extras are great. It has the audition footage.
Yeah, it's a good little thriller, and it's very well done. And I look forward to the next film. I mean, to the point. I mean, I'll disagree with Mr. Ratliff in that I think his film is far better than Cachet.
Okay, so let's go to our next one, which is Sunshine. Correct.
Sunshine by Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Which is, for me, I know a lot of people were kind of iffy on this. To me, was a more of a return to form after both, you know, The Beach and 28 Days Later, which Wasn't a big fan of The Beak. I thought DiCaprio was fine. 28 Days Later is a good film for about two-thirds, and it kind of deteriorates in that final sequence. 28 Weeks Later, to me, is better. But here he really maintains the tension and deals with a lot of moral quandaries of, do we, you know, saving the planet versus, well, we have to, you know, how much can we sacrifice in manpower in order to save, you know, humanity, basically.
Right.
And I will say the structure of the film is actually very similar to Cameron's The Abyss, in that
mm-hmm.
one obstacle pops up, and once that obstacle has overcome, it may be overcome, but by overcoming that obstacle, another obstacle pops up. Like, so you fix something, but it's one of those deals, well, if we fix this, this problem's going to happen. They're like, okay, well, let's fix it, and then we'll fix that other problem. So like The Abyss, it has that kind of chain, you know, of events that really go one lead one problem to another, and that's very that creates enormous tension. And also,
it's a great looking movie too. I mean, it's an independent movie, but it's great looking. And what strikes me about Danny Boyle is his versatility as a director. He's not confined by genre.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And who's the guy from the Fantastic Four?
The guy who played Johnny Storm. I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Chris Evans. He's terrific in the film, and so is he's a real surprise. I look forward to his next non-Fantastic Four movie. Rose Byrne, who's the female lead. I saw this film after I'd seen the season of Damages on FX, and she was terrific in that, and now she's terrific here. So that, I mean, there's a lot of that, and it's just it's a good looking, crisp looking film. Danny Boyle, it's more of a kind of return to form, and like I said, if you like The Abyss, I really think you'll like Sunshine structurally. And if anything, another selling point, it's about a half hour shorter than The Abyss.
It's quite brief. Yeah, and Cillian Murphy's in it too, and he has a very odd, captivating quality that's not like anyone else, really.
Oh,
he's got the
best cheekbones since Guy Pearce.
Yeah. And
now we're back to
Chuck and Larry. So, let's Sunshine, do we recommend?
Oh, Sunshine, sure. Danny Boyle's commentary is actually very funny. He acknowledges the presence of both, you know, 2001 and Blade Runner and Alien. He goes, you know, whenever you make a sci-fi film that's not quote-unquote fantasy, he goes, it's inevitable that at some point you might as well just get it over with and acknowledge those three films
right. That,
you know, they're going to be lingering over you. And so he's very witty and very, it's a good commentary. It's a terrific
commentary. Let's go to our last film tonight, which will be Halloween, the DVD
the unrated
of
version.
That.
Which is the unrated version.
Yes.
Yeah, more tits and blood, basically.
Okay. We all know Chris didn't care for it that much. I
did like the first third of the movie. I did say that. I thought that the rest of the movie was not a step forward for Rob Zombie. But while even the first third I had problems with, there's definitely some stuff in it that's worth seeing.
Yeah, and there are, to me, it's funny, so the second time, I still think, even in that last third where he's basically remaking the Carpenter film,
he is. Yeah.
He does a couple of things that do made me jump. There's one great sequence where he goes to Laurie Strode's parents' house and attacks her, and his attack is so timed off kilter that it is startling when he pounces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is
it's a brutal movie.
It is brutal, but it's the equivalent of how brutal the first Halloween was back in 1978. Now
right. We've
kind of upped the ante.
Yeah, I like this movie. I did not mind it. I did not mind it at
and
all.
I will say I much prefer the theatrical ending to the alternate ending offered on this DVD, but it's fascinating to see.
Yeah, it is. Me and Jamie were talking about this, that original, quote-unquote, theatrical ending before they went back to reshoot. While it is an ending, it's still something very, it's just kind of bland and unsatisfying. This other ending is, while it still kind of leaves some loose ends, it is more effective.
Yeah. I think all in all, the fact that this Halloween was effective for me, was enough for me to recommend it, because after you make nine of anything, for it to be effective at all is an accomplishment unto itself.
Right.
And I think that we're all in agreement that Rob Zombie has a strong vision as director. He's very smart. He knows what he's doing. And and I agree with Chris, I like how he thought outside of the original Halloween, and really that's implicit in the explicit in the first half of it.
Right, it is.
And can we agree that Zombie is probably now he's one of the best when it comes to audio commentaries? I think he does terrific commentary.
Yeah, he's very good. He's very good. Yeah, he's very very entertaining and energetic and informative about it. He makes it clear from the very beginning of the commentary. He said, "I'm here to talk through every single second of Halloween," you know, and there's no lulls. You know, he doesn't stop and watch the movie with you necessarily. And I hate that in commentaries when you feel like, you know, why am I having on the commentary? There's talk going on.
And
it's not like
one of
that.
The best filmmakers are guilty of that too. I won't make names.
You know, and he acknowledges, he acknowledges mistakes. And he acknowledges, went back and reshot this because I didn't know what I was doing. He's very candid about stuff that he wrote that he didn't need and stuff that, you know, was actually created on the spot and that turned out better than before. And I will say this probably has, and you wouldn't find this in a horror film. Usually it's saved for, like, Jackie Chan films or whatever, or comedies. But I think Halloween Unrated, the DVD, the bloopers reel, is actually the best, one of the best blooper reels I've seen in a long time because Malcolm McDowell is hysterical in the blooper.
He's cut up. Yeah.
He's terrific.
I mean, he and Brad Dourif, like, go off on each other forever and a day. And like, let's place a couple of audio clips very quickly. This first one is from Malik Akkad. He's the producer of the Halloween franchise and sole producer of this latest one, the main producer. His father started the legacy, and he kind of picked up on it. His decision to choose Rob Zombie and Rob Zombie brought to the material.
You know, it's sort of turned out to be kind of an updating of the original theme.
Right.
But the original theme is almost as iconic as the mask. You know, to do it without that would be like trying to do it without the mask. And,
I agree.
You know, after Bob Weinstein brought up Rob Zombie to me, we had one meeting literally, and he came in and he pitched his idea. And he just had such a great take on it, such a great feel for it, and I felt such a great respect for the film, the original, that was it. It was one meeting, and he was off writing his script. And his first draft that, you know, you rarely get a first draft that comes in that was that strong. We were all so excited, and, you know, we didn't set anything out in front of him and saying, can't do this, can't do that. And what he delivered was just, you know, I felt, right on the money.
And here's another clip, a final clip of Christina Kleeb. These shows are all available in our archive section. Christina Kleeb is one of the actresses in the film. She plays one of the circle of friends that Michael Myers targets. And here she's speaking about the scrutiny that this remake was under compared to with the fans of the original film.
Yeah. So were you aware of the level of scrutiny this project would be under by the diehard fans of that original movie?
No, I didn't. And I didn't even until we finished shooting, because it wasn't until after we finished shooting that I started, like, looking on the internet. And I never even had, I had, like, a MySpace page that had, like, four friends, you know? and I never, you know, never really went on it. And suddenly, I think it was Scout that said, you know, you should really go on MySpace or, you know, connect with Rob Zombie on MySpace. So I was like, oh, sure, I'll connect with Rob Zombie. And then all of a sudden, like, a world opened up to me, a world of what, you know, the fans are really, you know, I think the internet is a huge place for horror fans. And so I didn't realize until after we finished shooting and until I started getting into that world that, you know, there were things like, oh, my God, how many totallys does the Linda say? Or, you know, do you die the same way? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, if I had known this before, I might have added a few things in there. But
yeah, they're
you
very
know.
Possessive over every little detail, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
I think generally what we're saying is obviously the audience ate this movie up. It was a big success in the box office. I think that anyone that enjoyed it at the theater, it's a must-own. I mean, absolutely pick it up, and the special features are more than worth it. Do you agree, Aaron?
I do agree. That second, it's not where it's just, let's just throw some things in. There's actually thought into these you know, makeup, effects, and cast. And he has the audition tapes of a lot of the actresses. And so there is Zombie is very, I feel so far, is very generous and very considerate about when he puts it on the DVD into the two-disc thing, because it's not just thrown to the wolves.
Yeah, and he seems very down-to-earth with his fans, too, you know.
Yeah.
Which I respect a lot. Guys, it's been a great show.
It's been a great year.
Been a great year. The other star, last show of the year. Silent tear. but we got an exciting 2008 planned for you guys, and stay tuned to the blog postings and the upcoming show listings. We might have a show on Wednesday, but we'll definitely be back next Sunday regardless. But we'll see you guys out there. And thanks so much for listening and joining us in the chat room.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Appreciate your support. Happy New Year, guys, and Happy New Year to all of our listeners. Bye-bye.
Bye.